I apologize. We're late getting started because of me. I couldn't tear myself away from the radio. The Wise County Airport has registered winds at 65 miles an hour that are headed toward Denton and Azle. And we do have a warning system. And if we hear the warning system, I have written instructions right here that I will read to you. So they consist of go to the stairwell. But I do have them here in case I forget what I'm supposed to say. So I apologize for the late start. It's entirely my fault. The panel, your panel for this afternoon is to my right, Justice Bob McCoy, to my left, Justice Bill Meyer. I'm Leanne Dofano. And the second case set for oral argument at 1:30 has been postponed, so we will hear your case at 1:30, and then we have another case we'll hear at 3 o'clock. Those are the only cases we have for oral submission. So if you're, I understand you're ready to get started, so if you call the case, please. Do you go by JB?
I go by Jack, Your Honor.
Jack, okay. All right, Jack, we're ready for you then.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, counsel. As I was just introduced, Your Honor, my name is Jack Peacock, and I'm with the law firm of Gagnon, Peacock, and Varicki. And I represent Mr. Mike Miller and All Economy and ABC Auto Parts. As you probably recall from the briefs, this is a summary judgment case. It has somewhat of an interesting history. Mr. Miller and his firms purchased a gaming trailer at a public auction in Louisville in November the 13th of 2003. Well, he bought it to sell, and he found out about 6 months later, 5 months later, in April, when he got served with a Chapter 47 proceeding in Grand Prairie, that the vehicle was stolen. And so the court in the Chapter 47 proceeding turned the vehicle over to the owners, H&W Risk Management, Inc., and Robert West.
There seemed to be a difference of opinion as to whether or not they would have owed the storage fees. Could you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. In my opinion, and based upon the research that we did, it's pretty clear that the storage fees would have been owed. Now, I know counsel for H&W and Bob West rely on the 1994 case of Bosworth, but that's a little different. And not only that, well, first of all, let me address how it's different. In the Bosworth case, what happened was the vehicle that was later determined to be stolen was in police custody, and the wrecker service proceeded to sell the vehicle under a foreclosure proceeding, rather than through the city, which is what it should have done. That wasn't done in this case. But what the court said was that the since the vehicle was technically in police custody, that the record service had no authority, they couldn't sell it apart from the city. And that differs from this case for the simple reason that in our case, it was sold through the proceeding, the City of Louisville proceeding, and Proto was paid. Now, the interesting thing is, and I think what they're trying to dispute is that, well, because of the Bosworth case, there was no lien. Well, Bosworth doesn't say that. Bosworth says that they didn't have the authority to sell it because it was under police custody. It still had the vehicle. As a matter of fact, it's pretty clear. I probably could have dealt with it a little bit better in my reply brief, but there's a number of cases that I cited in my response that are in the record in the in my response to the MSJ that say that, first of all, property code section 70.003C authorizes a lien when a garageman came into possession of the property lawfully. Well, it's undisputed here that the garageman, that being Proto, came into the possession of the trailer lawfully. So they had a lien. Could they have done like they did in the Bosworth case and sell it outside of the city? No. That clearly, under Bosworth, that would have been improper. But in the incident case, that's not what happened. And so the point being that the lien is still in effect. The storage keeper does have, garage keeper does have the right to their monies. And so that's the important thing. And by the way, there's one more case I cited in my response to the MSJ, which is not in the briefing. I don't think, at least I didn't see it in anybody's briefing, but an Austin case called Elite Towing versus LSI, the site being 985 Southwest 2nd, 635, and in particular, page 640. It's a 1999 Austin case. And I think that that also stands for the same proposition. So in response to your question, I hope that covered it reasonably well. Now, going to the issues that are here before the court, first of all, I don't know if you recall or saw from the record that when we originally sued the City of Louisville because my client wanted his money back after in the Chapter 47 hearing, he lost possession of the trailer. The City of Louisville didn't give him his money back, and so he sued the City of Louisville and Proto, and later H&W Risk Management and Bob West. The City of Louisville filed a plea to the jurisdiction, and the court granted the plea, dismissed the case against the City of Louisville on immunity. It went to this court and then to the Supreme Court, and they were immune from liability. So the City of Louisville is out of it. The remaining defendants, Proto and H&W Risk Management, of course, our theories of recovery differ. It's the same cause of action in the sense that the transaction was the purchase of the trailer that were sold by what by the city of Louisville based on information provided by Proto. So our beef, and I want to hasten to add here, I noticed that a couple places in the briefing that Proto is taking the position that, well, number one, the statute of limitations, but as the court knows under the relation back theory, all of our theories of recovery are based upon the transaction that happened on November 13th. That's when the damage occurred to my client. That's when he purchased the trailer. So their contention that, well, this actually goes back before then, the things that they did that were wrong, some of which occurred before then, but the transaction that forms the basis of our loss occurred on November 13, 2003, when the trailer was sold. So
the judgment doesn't recite the basis for granting the summary judgment, and I didn't have access to it. Was the motion's sole basis limitations?
No, Your Honor. It had other bases as well. But that was the thrust of it's. That's been the thrust of their position from the get-go, and the same with H&W and Bob West. Now, Bob West, remember, is a little different because the interesting thing about this case is that there's different theories of recovery that are added as discovery proceeded. And remember, the case was on hold all during the time that the appeals with the city of Louisville were going on. So the case is just sitting there until all of those are exhausted. So then we come back, we do discovery, we discover we've got other theories of recovery, and we add those. And that's very common. Now, Bob West arguably was joined more than 4 years after the purchase. Well, he was. He was joined more than 4 years after the purchase. But the issue there is Bob West has liability to my client for the simple reason, under the same theory, equitable subrogation, for the simple reason that my client didn't discover that it was a stolen vehicle until April of 2004. And so he was sued before my client discovered that it was stolen. And there's no proof anywhere in the record that he should have discovered that prior to April of 2004. So all of the theories of recovery under the various statutes, the relation back theory, are proper and should not have been dismissed. Regarding the theories of the DTPA and fraud, of course, those turn on the fact that Proto gave information that was wrong to the city of Louisville when they gave my client the receipt for his money. The information that they gave to him said that the owner was notified on June 22nd of 2003. But the facts are that wasn't true. Now, arguably, there was a notification. My client, Mr. Miller, agreed. He saw a July listing of vehicles, but what the information that was provided by Proto to the City of Louisville Police Department when they made this auctioneer's this receipt was that notice had been given June 22nd. Why is that important? Because that would demonstrate to a purchaser like my client that, oh yeah, well, there was actual notification, when in reality there wasn't. Now, they're going to argue that, well, that the July notice was constructive notice, but my client saw the July notice, and that doesn't get them where they need to get because they lied to the person making the receipt. They said that notice was given on June 22nd, 2003, and that just was not true. So
Are you saying that the date of publication was different from that? Because as I understood it, they followed the statutory requirement of posting the information in the newspaper or wherever.
So they did. They did. But the problem is, and if they would have put the actual date of the notice in the newspaper, which was July the 13th, 2003, then okay. My client would have known that, okay, that's the notice they're talking about. They're not talking about the fact that they actually gave the owner notice, personal notice, not notice by publication. So see, then he would have been on alert that that's not, that may not be enough.
So are we quibbling about the word actual notice?
We're quibbling about the word that they said that they gave notice on June the 22nd, and that didn't happen.
The date is wrong.
Correct. That never happened.
Because the newspaper posting was in July.
July, correct.
Okay.
Secondly, Proto knew that there was a challenge to that title. They had a sworn affidavit from a lady that said that that trailer belonged to her. And my client testified, and the evidence shows that had he known that there was a challenge to that title, he never would have purchased that piece of property. Proto knew, they kept it to themselves, and didn't reveal that at the time of the sale, which they could have done because it was right there at their premises. And they had people there, according to the evidence and the testimony. So, number one, under the DTPA, and I know that under the DTPA, counsel will probably want to argue that, well, my client purchased it from the city of Louisville, so Proto has no privity with my client. Well, under one of the cases that's cited in the briefs, it's the Texas Supreme Court case, I'm running out of time. I guess.
Finish your thought.
Thank you. That privity is not necessary. Texas Supreme Court decided in that Amstead versus U.S. Brass case that privity is not required under the DTPA. So with
any
that.
Any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel, and clerks. My name is Tiffany Hertling, and I'm with the law firm of Holmes, Diggs, and Eames in Denton, and I represent Recovery Systems, better known or doing business as Proto, and so I will refer to them as Proto. And there were several misrepresentations that I just want to clarify before I really get into my argument. Mr. Miller claims that we made false, misleading, wrong representations to the city of Louisville. And the record is totally void of any representation that Proto made to the city of Louisville or that Proto made to Mr. Miller. The record doesn't really say how the June 22nd got on to the sales, the auction sales. The only thing that the record talks about is that in Mr. Green's deposition, that he never touched the form, so he doesn't know how or where the information came, but what normally happened was that the police would review their paperwork. And that's the only thing. We don't know if it was a mistake written when they were looking at something where the notice was done in the paper on June, and I have the notice was done on June 18th is the notice that I have. And I think that's supported by the record. And it is notice by citation. And in reviewing all of the briefing by the appellant, it appeared to me that they were arguing that actual notice or that particular notification was required of the owner. And under the transportation code, that's just not true. The notice that was provided regarding the notice by citation is exactly what the law provides for in this type of circumstance. Additionally, several times they had alluded that Proto gave the city of Louisville or provided them a stolen trailer. Well, it's not like Proto went out and got this trailer and gave it. They had a call from one of the citizens of Louisville. They picked up the trailer. They did exactly what they were supposed to do under the statute, which was notify law enforcement. And the law enforcement of Louisville, they're the ones that do the investigation, that make the notices. They're the ones that created the document that appellant is relying on to try to prove that we did some type of misrepresentation.
Let's go from sins of commission to sins of omission. What about Ms. Calista?
Well, one, I don't believe that Ms. Calista was ever proved to have any type of ownership in the trailer.
Proved is how about claimed?
Right. Well, I understand.
If I was going to buy something, I certainly want to know that there's someone over here claiming ownership of that.
And I understand that, but that would be the city of Louisville. The city of Louisville comes by and looks at all of the documentation and everything. That is the city of Louisville's determination whether to provide that to the public or not provide that to the public. Proto didn't conduct the auction. They didn't make the determination to do that. To put the burden, or what they're trying to do is create a burden or a duty upon somebody that had provided a abandoned trailer to law enforcement to go out and notify everybody that might be in a sale that they're not conducting?
You provided the information to the city.
It's in their files. The city would have had that information.
That didn't quite answer my question. What, there's a file there, and if the city wants to look at it, it can go look at it, and if it did, it would have found an affidavit? I mean...
Well, the record is void of any communication there.
Why would the city look in this file, whatever you're talking about?
Well, that was the normal procedure pursuant to Mr.
What's
Green.
In the file that the city would be looking there for?
Notices. What notices have, if anybody's come by, you know, just like that. If anybody's come by to claim, you know, how long the vehicle's been there, just the information on the vehicle, if there were any identification numbers on it.
Where exactly is this file?
It would be in Proto's offices.
How would the police know to go to Proto's offices to look for through? I mean, how would you feel if the police walked in and said, we want to go through your files and see if we see anything interesting?
No, I think that if you look back on Mr. Green's deposition, he said the normal, and I'm quoting, the normal practice is for the police to come and review the paperwork on
after
each.
After they're notified.
Right.
And you did notify them.
Yes. We had to notify them because then they came in and they're the ones that, and the record shows that they went in and they did several investigations to try to determine who owned the property and to see if there were any vehicle identification marks, because there were no VIN numbers, there were no license plates. None of those things were on this vehicle. And to the point of the Chapter 47 hearing, really, he should have notified the city of Louisville or Proto that this Chapter 47 hearing was going to happen. One of the things is that any interested party can come in and present their case. And at that Chapter 47 hearing, what would have happened is the city of Louisville would have said, hey, we have a garageman's lien in the amount of $6,900 that we had to pay for this. And that lien would have been paid for. I mean, and so by not notifying him, he cut off Proto's and the city of Louisville's remedy to be able to claim that amount of money. I mean, if that would have happened at this, and if he would have taken the Chapter 47 hearing seriously, we wouldn't be here today. And I disagree. I think that the Boswell case does go in and shows that law enforcement does have the ability to, or they're the only ones that have the ability to make the sale in this, and so I think that makes my argument. Additionally, I think that he also made my argument that we would have been compensated for those storage fees at that point in time, and then the rest of it would have been moot. We wouldn't be here. And Justice McCoy, I just wanted to address your question on the summary judgment. Yes, the summary judgment did talk about statute of limitations, but it also talked about all of these other
motion.
I mean, Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Yes. The motion for summary judgment that was originally filed did talk about the statute of limitations, but it also talked about and argued all of these points that are in front of you here today. And so I think that the law is that basically, since the order on the motion for summary judgment doesn't say specifically, then we can, okay.
You have to. Okay. The movement has to address, of course, every possible theory under which the motion should be granted. The movement here.
Yes.
The appellant here.
Right.
Ms. Harding, I would like to look a little bit at this affidavit of Ms. Callista. First, in the record, other than the filing of this affidavit, what part did Lisa Callista have in this whole process?
That's all I know. I mean,
she ever, never, no one ever took her deposition. No one ever had any contact with her. There's no testimony, nothing in the record other than this one document.
Yes, Your Honor. That's all that's here.
And it says on the copy that's filed as a part of the exhibits to the appellant's brief that there is references to see attached document. Then there's a number sign and White Carnival game trailer. And then another part where it says see attached documents. Well, there's not any documents attached to what we have here as a part of the briefing. And I'm just wondering if you can illustrate for me what other documents were attached to this affidavit, if you know.
Your Honor, I off the top of my head, I don't know. I remember seeing the document and that it had her affidavit and a couple of pictures with it, but that's all that I remember seeing with her affidavit off.
Okay, well, do you know whether or not she was claiming that she personally had a ownership interest in this trailer, or whether she was asserting a claim for some other entity or party as their representative?
Your Honor, the understanding from the affidavit, because that's all I have to go from, is that it was her, she was claiming it was hers.
She says, I'm the owner or the authorized representative of. That's what it says in the affidavit. We don't know which one she was asserting.
No, Your Honor.
Okay. There's some activity in the, you mentioned the activity in the Justice of the Peace Court in the Chapter 47 proceeding, and it appears to me that the named defendant in that proceeding was ABC Trailer and Auto Parts, and it was not any of the other parties that are the appellants, that being the All Economy Foreign and Dismantling, which apparently was a DBA assumed name for Mr. Miller. And I'm wondering if there is any connection to the Chapter 47 proceeding and the actual entity that's named as the purchaser on the auction receipt, which is the All Economy Foreign and Dismantling.
May I proceed?
Yes.
Thank you. Well, my understanding is that Mr. Miller owns all of these companies, that he purchased one and put it in and then actually transferred title to All Economy. And then he moved the trailer from his All Economy to the ABC, but he never transferred title.
Moved, you mean that he transferred
physically,
the physical,
yes,
the place where the trailer was located?
Yes. And then so I'm assuming from the record that when they picked it up, it was at that location, and so that's why they named ABC Late Model Trucking and not the other entities.
What, they being the police?
The police, yes, the law enforcement.
As a stolen item?
Yes.
All right, thank you, ma'am.
Any other questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Henry Werman, and I'm here on behalf of H&W Risk Management and Robert E. Bob West. We're the innocent bystanders who just want to recover what's rightfully and legally ours. when the trailer was stolen and it was recovered, and my client H&W paid Bob West the monies that he was owed under his insurance policy. They became the owners through that payment. When the trailer was ultimately discovered to be a stolen trailer, to be the one that H&W did own and did pay monies on, then H&W did what the law required. They went and appeared at a Chapter 47 proceeding. They tendered their evidence that they were the title owner. The appellant in this case did nothing. The appellant, although there, said not a word. The appellant, and this is a JP proceeding, it's the People's Court. It's there where he had the opportunity to say, wait a minute, I'm out money on this too. Don't I get something out of this? He said nothing. And the property was awarded to my client. The Supreme Court of Texas in York versus State, which I know is a familiar case to this court, stated that the true purpose of the Chapter 47 proceeding is to return property to its rightful owner. And although there were differences in the York case and this case, the essential element is that, similar to Mr. York, my client established that they had absolute ownership of the vehicle in question, the carnival trailer, which, as a bit of background to the court, it's one of those machines. It's a trailer that opens up into a booth, and it's one of those quarter push games. I'm sure you've seen, you put the quarter in the little slot, and it rolls down, and there's a thing that pushes all those nice watches and things that never get fall forward, but the little, you know, keychains do sometimes. So that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about a game trailer, and it was filled with the plush toys and the prizes and everything else, even the quarters.
Were you responsible for the towing fees?
We are not responsible for the towing fees, Your Honor. And the reason we're not responsible is Bosworth versus Dodge.
Who's responsible for them?
Obviously, if
this had gone correctly, you paid, you got the trailer, the towing fees or storage fees are out there. So what, they just get stiffed, or who's responsible for them?
Well, Justice McCoy, to understand why they get stiffed is...
That's the answer, they get stiffed?
Yes, because, and the reason being is that this auction is conducted not at a set price per vehicle plus stowage and storage fees. In the record, and the testimony is, that when a person goes to these auctions, they're there and they can bid on whatever vehicle they want, and if nobody else bids on it, they get it. And if they bid 10 cents, it goes to them for 10 cents. If the towing and storage fees are $5,000, well, they divvy up the dime between the police department and themselves. But that is different than saying you have a lien attached to the vehicle as a result of the payment of the storage and towing fees. And that's not what we're talking about here. The towing and storage fees were paid. What the appellant is arguing is that because he paid them, he has a lien, and so he can go against the innocent purchaser, the true owner, and recover this money from them. When the classic definition of a lien does not apply in this circumstance.
Your position is you would not have had to pay the storage fees.
Our position is we would not have had to pay the storage fees under the authority of the Bosworth versus Dodge case. And both the Bosworth and the Dodge case and the case that's cited by the appellant before this court, the Elite Towing case, were both cases where the towing company said to the rightful owner of the vehicle, we're not turning this vehicle over to you until you pay our towing and storage fees. The rightful owner sued for conversion. The rightful owner was awarded not only conversion damages, but in the Bosworth case, punitive damages and attorney's fees. For these reasons, we pray that the judgment of the trial court be upheld.
Any other questions?
I have one other question that's not been touched on, and I'd appreciate you addressing it, Mr. Wehrman. That is, in terms of the relation back theory on the discovery and the discovery rule in terms of applying the statute of limitations, your position in your briefing is that because we talk about the transaction being a sale whereby at an auction whereby the one of the appellants, All Economy and Foreign, acquired the trailer and was listed as the purchaser at the sale. That's one part of this transaction. And then when the initial litigation gets filed, there's no mention of H&W or Mr. West until more than 4 years later. And then the idea is, well, we're all still talking about this one auction, this one purchase, but we'd have different parties. And your position is that relation back doesn't apply whenever there are different parties at the time when the lawsuit's filed, as opposed to the time whenever the question of the four-year statute of limitations is being applied.
Well, that's correct, Justice Meyer. We were not a party to this lawsuit initially. We were brought in before 4 years expired, but our argument is that it's the two-year statute of limitations which is applicable here, and the two-year statute of limitations had already expired. In other words, we were brought in after 2 years, but the argument is exactly the same, and I agree with you 100%. If you are not a party to a lawsuit, regardless of the subject matter or your involvement in it, until you're named and made a party to the lawsuit, the limitations continues to run.
And you don't get to relate back to the original lawsuit, and the time of the filing of the original lawsuit is applicable to the time frame to evaluate the two-year period. However, you also have to have, at the time of the filing of the original lawsuit, the correct parties to the suit in order for the relation back to apply to those parties.
That's correct, Justice Meyer. We do not have a Continental Trailway situation here where they, you know, where Bob West was confused with Roy West and, you know, he didn't get sued properly. There's no confusion as to the parties. There's no allegation that there is. There's no alter ego. It is pure and simple. We were not a party to the lawsuit till after the...
Well, you do have an alter ego in the sense that Mr. Miller was doing business as All Economy Foreign and Dismantling, who was the original purchaser.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, that not on their part. But what I was saying is that from the defendant part, there's no issue of mistaken defendant or
right. It didn't put you in there and then have you later be a different name, but it was really the right people that just misnamed.
Right. We were the right people, just too late.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Justice Meyer. Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Dovner.
Is there a rebuttal?
Just a couple of items. Number one, Your Honor, on the relation back, that's exactly correct. Unless the party is in the lawsuit, then the relation back's not going to work. But in this case, they were in the lawsuit.
Wait. The relation back doctrine applies to causes of action, not to parties.
Well, yes.
So if you got the parties in the case and it's over the same transaction, you can take a cause of action, which you later develop, and it'll relate back to the original filing.
Right. Exactly.
All right.
And that's exactly what we did here. I mean, once first of all, their argument is that it's a two-year statute of limitations. If it's 2 years, then we're out. But I disagree. It's four because it comes under the residual statute. And the residual statute, as you know, is 4 years. They're in because of the four-year statute, and Mr. West is in because of the discovery. In other words, it wasn't discovered until later that he actually was the true owner. So they're in time-wise.
Who was sued originally?
The city of Louisville.
City of Louis, of Louisville, and?
Well, the city of Louisville alone was sued first.
Right.
And then Proto, was brought in. And Proto was brought in timely. I don't think there's even any issue about that.
So when was the first time that H&W Risk Management, Inc. was named in a plaintiff's petition?
Let's see.
More than 3.5 years, but not four, but more than two.
More than two, correct. But not more than four.
Right. And then Mr. West is named at the same time.
Well, he's not named until about 4 months later. I want to say, well, maybe not 4 months later, but a few months later.
I just have trouble keeping track of the 9 petitions is my problem, and I can't recall the dates on which one was filed when.
I can, Your Honor, if it'll help, I can send a short letter brief.
I just haven't had a chance to get into the shucks. So I don't need you to send anything else. I just looked at it from the briefing standpoint, and it wasn't real clear from the briefs exactly when what was filed.
The only other issue I think I need to deal with relating to their arguments is in the Chapter 47 hearing, I believe you asked about that, and that ABC was the only named party, and that's correct. However, if you look at the second, it's page 1342. It shows the parties that were present at that hearing, and it shows that Mr. Miller was there in behalf of All Economy. So, and even in his affidavit, that's attached to our response to the motions for summary judgment, he states that he was there.
Well, he was president of ABC Late Model Truck and Auto Parts, Inc., wasn't he?
Yes.
So he could have been there in his capacity as president, not been there in his capacity as an individual and DBA owner, or owner of a DBA All Economy Foreign and Dismantling.
But it says in the on page 1342 that he was there on behalf of All Economy. So.
Okay.
Yeah, he was there and on behalf of All Economy, and counsel, of course, is trying to say that, well, he didn't do enough at that hearing, but the reality is a JP court is not a court of record, and so there's no record of exactly what happened except what the decision of the court was, and that was that he was out the trailer. And there was no provision for him to get his monies back from these other parties in that order. He was just out the trailer. So I think based on the VC, and let me just quickly point out the VSC case, which is the Texas Supreme Court case, and I think it's cited a few times. Interestingly, in footnote 10, the court says, we assume without deciding that a licensed vehicle storage facility may have a garageman's lien in a stored vehicle and that a garageman's lien may exist in stolen property. And then they quote Texas Property Code section 70.003C, which says that that's included. Well, it doesn't say stolen vehicles in that section, but the case that comes right up before the Supreme Court decision, when it was a Dallas decision, says that the lien is a good lien, and that was not reversed by the Texas Supreme Court's version of the VCS case, Dallas, City of Dallas versus VCS. So I think I'm out of time, but.
Okay, let me see if I'm beating a phantom horse. The judgment doesn't tell us why summary judgment was granted.
That's correct.
It's your brief, and you have two issues. One, the statute of limitations does not bar appellant's claims. The trial court erred in dismissing appellant's claim. Two, I look over at the appellee's brief, Appellant's claims are barred by the statute of limitations. The trial court did not err in dismissing appellant's claim. So it's pretty obvious. One of the grounds for the motion for summary judgment was limitations.
Correct.
Normally, I would think we would see, okay, and the other grounds were A, B, C, D, and E, and I'm going to address every one of those, but I don't see that. But what you're telling me is that all of the grounds that were urged to grant summary judgment, which are each and every potential reason to support the judgment, are contained in these two issues of limitations and trial court erred in dismissing appellant's claims.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Okay.
All right. Anything else?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. We appreciate your argument, and we appreciate your coming here in this weather. Be careful going home. You are excused to go about your business. Your case is submitted. We'll be in recess until 3 o'clock.